Session number 13300, reel number 1.
Reel 1, can we start with your telling me how and when you came to be in the Navy in the first place, please?
Yes, I was working in the City of London after I left school, and in 1938 I applied to join the London Division of the then Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. This was at the time of the Munich crisis, but so many volunteers come along that the lists were closed. So as soon as Munich had quietened down, I reapplied and was accepted for training in the then signal branch. And this would have been in end of 1938, I think.
What were you doing when war was declared?
When war was declared, I had already been called up and was awaiting a posting in the Royal Naval Barracks in Devonport until I was assigned to a ship.
What was your reaction to the news that we were at war with Germany? Was it dismay or exhilaration or what?
I think it was just full acceptance of what was inevitable. It was certainly a change from slaving in the city.
Can you tell me a bit about the training that you had?
Well, as you probably well know, the call-up was at the beginning of the war was tremendous. We were crammed into the barracks in Devonport in conditions which no one would tolerate today. The crowding was so great that each night, instead of sleeping in the barracks, I used to go out into Plymouth and spend a night in the Salvation Army hostel, which cost me all of 1 shilling. And that at least I had a decent night's sleep. Coming back into barracks in the morning, one at about 6:30, one entered into what I can only describe as a thick fog. What it must have done to the health of some of those men, I cannot imagine.
What did you think of the standard of training that you received?
Well, I was in the signal school, which was then situated in the barracks, and having trained or received training in communications whilst in the London Division, it was a continuation of that, and it was the standard of training was quite good and adequate with the staff available. Classes were quite large, but it at least prepared us for our task when we eventually went to sea.
How keen were you to go to sea?
I think being, in my middle 20s, I think it was every young man's ambition to go to sea. Those who joined the Navy, that was what it was all about.
And what was your first ship?
Apart from a couple of very temporary appointments, my first seagoing ship was, in fact, one of the old First World War destroyers, the Witch. And we were working in cooperation with another V&W class destroyer, the Wren, going out from Plymouth, picking up a westbound convoy, taking it out to about 10 degrees west, picking up an inbound convoy and taking it up channel to Dover, where we turned round, picked up yet another westbound convoy from the Downs and peeled off when we were relieved to go back into Devonport for a couple of days layover. This, as I say, was in 1938. well, the end of 1939, November time, till about, when did I leave the ship? January. Conditions in the out on the Western Ocean at that time were pretty horrendous.
Because of that bad winter?
Because of the bad weather, yes, that bad winter weather.
Did you ever run into the enemy? Or was it just...
No, we were lucky in that respect. We met no enemy ships, surface or submarines. Mark, it was the early days of the war and the submarines hadn't really got operating in the Western Ocean by that time.
Did you enjoy your first ship?
No, not particularly. I was the only reserve rating on in that particular branch. There were only four of us in the signal branch. I had a pig of a yeoman who treated me very badly. I chummed up with one of the others, but I think the redeeming, because conditions in the ship in those days were pretty basic. We were, our mess was down, two decks down, just about on the waterline, with only a small hatchway to for escape should anything happen to the ship. I think the redeeming feature was that having spent some 6 or 7 years in the city, in commerce, I had experience of the outside world which the officers of the ship seemed to lack. They were all active service officers, and having gone to Dartmouth at the age of 13, they had virtually no experience of what went on outside, and so they would talk to me. I know I was only a young boy at the time, but much of what I had to tell them, they could barely understand. So there was a sort of liaison there, which was very good, very interesting. And, of course, I suppose, in a way, it helped me, because whether it was through the captain of that particular ship or not, I don't know, but I received a recommendation to go to HMS King Alfred for training for my commission. And on the day I was due to leave the ship, I received an invitation to drinks in the water room, which in the Navy of that time was something unheard of for a rating.
Because of the gulf between them?
Because of the tremendous, yes, the unseen barrier between the ratings and the officers. That is so.
Why was this yeoman such a pig?
He didn't like the idea of anybody from outside, previously outside the service, doing a job which he thought only he himself could do. He was very he'd just been promoted up to petty officer rating, and it was just his manner. It was very unfortunate.
And at King Alfred, what did you think of the course there?
That was good fun. I joined in January 1940, the class of 49, all all RNVR ratings from the various divisions throughout the country, and we were accommodated in the building of what had started out life as something we should know today as a leisure centre. And the Admiralty took over the whole building, which is there today. And we were accommodated there down in the garage. But we fed in one of the big swimming pool areas which had been boarded over, which was used as the dining room. And we were all sat behind a rope which kept us away from the other officers under training who had mostly been officers of the one of the divisions of the RMBR, or of the peculiar Royal Naval Volunteer Supplementary Reserve, which had been formed a few years previously of volunteers who, in the event of war, agreed to be called up for naval service. But they were all of potential officer rank. But by and large, the training we received was excellent. It was good fun. And it was a bitterly cold winter, but nevertheless we survived. We were distinguished, of course, by wearing a white band round our caps instead of the usual ship's tally. That's the name, ribbon, which carries the ship's name.
I think King Alfred was in the Brighton area.
It was, in fact, it's in Hove. As I say, the building's there, there to this day, and it is a leisure centre, and it's still known as the King Alfred Building.
So then you got your commission, what happened to you then?
In April, I was commissioned as a temporary sub-lieutenant RMVR, with all one gold stripe on my arm. And then I went back to King Alfred for a short course in navigation, and then I was appointed to the second ML flotilla, ML being a motor launch. They were 112-foot wooden construction vessels designed primarily for anti-submarine work. We were then based in Gosport, and I did I joined number 115, if I remember rightly. Unfortunately, she was only in the final stages of fitting out, and the electricians who were installing the radio equipment must have left a loose wire or left a cigarette burning, because we had a fire on board one night, and unfortunately subsequently lost one rating through smoke inhalation.
This was on board your ML-115?
This was on 115, yes. We then had to take her back to the builders in the Hamble, and then I had a period of joining temporarily another flotilla until I was reappointed to the ship in which I served for the next couple of years. That was number 134. She was part of the third flotilla, and we were then destined to go out to Gibraltar. So we spent quite some time having extra fittings put on board, particularly long-range tanks to take in that sufficient fuel to get us to Gib, some 2,000 miles. That was all in the Hamble area until we got together and eventually sailed down in company to Plymouth, fueled, ready to set out for Gib when sufficient escorts were made available. This was in April 1941.
And what group of ships eventually went out to Gibraltar?
There were two destroyers and a flower class corvette. Yes, that's right. The three HM ships escorted the 8 MLs of our flotilla, and we had a safe, uneventful passage to Gibraltar. Once there, we were set to work on anti-submarine detection in the Strait of Gibraltar for the next virtually 12 months. This was in the event was a pretty pointless exercise, because there, in the Strait of Gibraltar, the waters there are two distinct levels. There's a big inflow on either above or below, I can't remember now which, and deeper down there's a flow in the opposite direction. So it meant that submarine detection using the ASDIC equipment, if it hit the layer, it bounced back. So any submarine that was below this layer was virtually undetectable. And in fact, many got through later on. There was the occasional possible detection, but nothing was ever found. Although there was one armed boarding vessel. It had been a big private yacht called the Rosabelle, which the Admiralty had taken over. The armed boarding vessel being part of the examination service, which had authority to stop any merchant ship and inspect it for its, to make sure its papers were in order and it was not carrying any goods to the enemy. She disappeared without trace one night. So we never knew quite what happened to her. We assumed that she was torpedoed. But I did later, some week or so later, recover one of her life buoys. On another occasion, one of the anti-submarine trawlers, the Lord Stanley, I think she was, she also disappeared somewhere off the Moroccan coast.
What about the question of so-called neutral Spain and its sympathy towards the Axis cause at that time?
Well, Spain, of course, so it was so-called neutral, but in fact was in some ways covertly assisting the Axis, because in Algeciras harbour there was an Italian tanker whose name escapes me, but it'll be on record, which lay alongside the outer mole. And later it was discovered that in the forepeak, the Italian engineers, by their ingenuity in shifting the ballast, had raised the bow sufficiently to enable a hole to be cut in the shell of the ship, made watertight, so that when ballast was shifted, this eventually became below the waterline. And placed on board, again, covertly, presumably at night, were one-man torpedoes. The Italian crew, of course, remained on this tanker, and their specialist seamen, in fact, launched these one-man torpedoes at night, crossed the bay, and on one occasion penetrated Gibraltar Harbour and sank a big tanker, one of the Dales. So part of our job additionally in Gibraltar was to carry out night patrols, dropping small charges off the two entrances, which didn't do much for the morale sleep of the crews of the ships that were in the harbour, because they were 5-pound charges and they made quite a bang. But that only lasted for a matter of a few months.
What was life like in wartime Gibraltar?
Oh, that was tremendous. It was great fun. The Gibraltar was crowded, of course, with mainly troops and, of course, a lot of navy, and indeed the Royal Air Force, who were flying Sunderlands and Catalinas on long-range patrols out into the Atlantic, anti-U-boat patrols. In fact, on one occasion, one Catalina probably performed the longest flight of any aircraft of that time. She took off, I think, at about 5 minutes to midnight and returned about 5 minutes after midnight 2 days later. So she was in the air for about 26 hours. And it was quite an achievement. I was going to say, of course, they had to take off in the bay, so they did infringe, if you can call it that, possibly the Spanish airspace, but nobody interfered with them. So operations carried on. There were, of course, a number of transit flights, craft coming out from UK, refueling, and going onto the Middle East.
What kind of things would you do ashore in Gibraltar? Where would you go?
Oh, there were clubs and pubs and restaurants. Life was quite easy, really. I mean, there was a very, very, very good club called the Naval Officers Pavilion, which was a club for servicemen. There was the yacht club, who made us very welcome at any time we'd wanted to go in for drinks or meal. Plenty of life going on in the town. The only thing, of course, was that all the British female population had been evacuated. There were, however, a number of wrens serving there, and also nurses from the three services. So life wasn't entirely sterile.
So what was the attitude of the Gibraltarian?
Oh, they were for us to a man. Absolutely, yes. Their future depended on us being there. And this is true today. In fact, I was out in Gibraltar in the 60s when there was some question that Gibraltar might be handed back to Spain. And there were banners in all the flats, the big high-rise flats facing over no man's land towards Spain, saying, "British we are, British we stay in Gibraltar." And that attitude, as far as I know, is the same today. I've not been out there since 1966, I think. But I have good friends out there, and they say the same.
How long did you say you were serving Gibraltar at this time?
About 12 months, yes, actually, about 14 months, yes.
Any other incidents or anecdotes from those
from
days?
Gibraltar? Nothing of any particular note, no. The odd plane which came, having taken off, of course, from the runway, which was then very short, there was no question of touching down again. You had to circle the rock if you were in trouble to come back onto the runway. On one occasion, I heard an aircraft take off, and I heard it making a peculiar noise, and I said to my number one, "That's in trouble. Let's go and chase after it." And, of course, it did. It came down in the water just south of Europa Point, and we were fortunate to rescue several members of the crew. The ASR launch also came out, and that rescued the remainder. I think there were five altogether. But that's the sort of thing that was almost run-of-the-mill.
How did you come to leave Gibraltar?
Ah, that we now come to the interesting part. In, I suppose, about March, possibly even February, but we'll say March of 42, it was realised that Malta was in very dire straits. It was then had suffered the tremendous bombing which is on record, and they were getting very short of food. The Italian E-boats had laid hundreds of mines outside the harbour, making it very difficult for the submarines to operate. And in fact, we lost several submarines, including the famous Upholder, in which Lieutenant Commander Wanklyn earned his Victoria Cross. So it was decided by their lordships, presumably, that two of our flotilla would be modified in the dockyard in Gibraltar to carry out minesweeping duties. This involved quite an extensive alterations. It meant taking off our ancient 3-pounder main armament forward, fitting a second mast, and fitting two single barrel Oerlikon guns, one forward and one fairly amidships aft, and fitting minesweeping gear, which was the Mark V Oropesa, enabling the vessels to sweep down to a moderate depth sufficient to allow ships to pass on the surface. Now, two of our flotilla were selected, number 126 and 130, and they were ordered to make their way in company, unescorted, to Malta, using any ruse de guerre that they might consider suitable for the occasion. Bear in mind, they had to pass off the Moroccan, Algerian, Tunisian coasts, parts of which, of course, at that time were in French hands, whose sympathies the French with was open to question, but one had one's own ideas. In the event, both arrived safely in Malta and started immediately on anti-submarine work. Not only that, they used to go out at night to patrol and try and scare off any E-boat that was attempting to lay mines. Unfortunately, 130 met up with one of the E-boats one night, and being no match for it, was sunk. However, I gather that most of the crew were rescued. I know personally that the commanding officer and the first lieutenant were rescued, and I think most of the crew were as well. 126 survived and carried on its minesweeping. The only other minesweepers there were two rather ancient trawlers which had been fitted with minesweeping gear. During 126's time, she was attacked by three... I'm not sure what planes were, but she was attacked by three, and she shot down two, and the other one made off. This was in daylight, off while she was actually sweeping off Malta, and for this the commanding officer received a DSC. Due to the success